Welcome to the F1 Strategy Report for Apex Race Manager, the mobile management simulator. On this week's edition, the Azerbaijan Grand Prix. What was behind Sebastian Vettel's race-deciding brain snap to hit Lewis Hamilton? And Ferrari's engines no longer feeling the burn. That's all to come in this edition of the Strategy Report. My name is Michael Laminato, and joining me this week from Sky Sports F1, it's Ted Kravitz. How are you doing?
Hi, all right. Slightly tired, but yeah, not bad.
I like the idea that something as simple as a name change has really made a very good race. European Grand Prix last year, very straightforward and boring. This year, put Azerbaijan in the name, and look what we've got.
Oh, was that what did it? Okay.
Presumably.
It seemed to be... a lot of things were different, actually. It seemed to be a bit more of a sort of, you know, reckless approach to the race. They were throwing it around, weren't they, around the streets. Whereas last year, they all sort of turned up and was like, oh, careful of the castle section, you know, careful of that bump before the left-hand presidential palace turned 15, or whatever it was. And then, you know, but this year it was like, oh, come on, let's have it.
I liked the idea that last year they saw GP2, which was... Boy, this was an incredible race of just carnage, and that really warded them off. Normally, it's the opposite way that kind of learning takes place.
I know. Anyway, it was a fairly long weekend. Yeah, so I'm just back, thankfully, I didn't get the Formula One charter back because that had a 5-hour delay with my colleagues. Where the parking brake, there was something wrong with the braking system on the Boeing 767 that they were chartering. And they were looking at spending another Monday night in Baku again. But luckily they managed to get the, whatever it was, fixed, and have landed just recently in Luton with a sort of 4 or 5 hour delay, which is... But I came back Lufthansa, and they were... a paragon of German efficiency.
Which is all you really need after a weekend over in Azerbaijan. It was an interesting weekend to set up with, I suppose. As we've learned with Pirelli so far this year, tyres are very hard, but also that I guess the pre-season expectations were for cars that were generating a lot more downforce. And given this is obviously not a permanent racing circuit, a street circuit, grip was extremely low. And everyone was having a great deal of difficulty pretty much from the start of practice and all the way through the race with these.
Yeah, and I think that was the tyres, actually. And just the fact the tyres were far too hard for the circuit, because even though the pit apron was dusty, and you could see that on the TV, and you could see the elements of the track were dusty as well, when you were there, they had sweepers out and track washing machines pretty much non-stop all day Thursday, and then Friday morning as well. So they did an incredible amount of, you know, attempts at track cleaning, much more than, say, Canada does, or Monaco does. So they did try and sweep up every last bit of dust, but no, in the race, actually, it was very dusty in the pit apron, so much that I have my iPhone out with running the timing app, and with a few pit stops coming and going, I was standing between Force India and Williams, my phone was just sort of covered with a film of sort of grime and dust. So it was weird, but yes it was just that the tyres, it seemed, were just too hard, as they have been pretty much at every race so far this season.
And it was interesting too, because they were too hard last year, and I know obviously the regulations have changed this year and no one knew exactly what was going to happen, but it was the same compound names that Pirelli brought, the super soft and medium. So I suppose in some respects a lot of the drivers should have been surprised that we didn't at least go a stop softer here with those tyres, and even the pressures were quite high as well, I think, weren't they?
Yeah, well, it doesn't really matter what you paint them. You know, this year's medium is last year's hard.
Exactly, yeah.
And it just goes for all the rest of them. So this year's ultra soft is last year's super soft. So yeah. But anyway, they'll change it. But ultimately, really, it wasn't really the the tyres didn't really make that much of a difference, did they?
No. Well, I guess unless you consider the idea, because one of the big stories coming into this race was how Mercedes would fare on this type of circuit. We saw in Monaco and Russia in particular, and on particularly Hamilton's car, that, as Toto Wolff said, bit of a diva of a car. Mm. Not quite so many problems here, at least by the time they got to qualifying. It was looking a bit questionable on Friday, but... I mean, is this a sign? I guess this is a question some people are asking, that if Mercedes gets on top of these problems, will we just go back to them having that upper hand for the rest of the season, do you think?
Yes, yes, and absolutely. And I think that's really the sort of missing story from actually what turned out in the race with Hamilton and Vettel and eventually Ricciardo winning, is that I think Mercedes, you know, are really very rapidly getting on top mm-hmm. of this diva of a car. And that was kind of the point of a piece that I think I did in our show early on in what they've done, how Mercedes rescued the weekend from what wasn't a good Friday into a great pole position for Hamilton. And, you know, they were commanding the race. So they've widened the window of you know, ability to get a good setup. It's much more drivable. They understand the tyres a little bit more. The car's less of a diva, effectively. So they are, you know, they are getting on top of it. And it's really... for Ferrari to respond. And I put this to Jock Clear on Friday after he did the team principal's press conference. And it's just, it was an engineer's press conference. He's not a team principal, of course. But and he was saying, well, you know, look, you know, we're aware that not that we need to respond, but we need to be good in the development race. So we are bringing little things to every race. We're not bringing, you know, one big upgrade package to, say, Silverstone in 4 weeks' time. It's bit by bit. We want to make actually absolutely sure that every bit we do bring works, which it has so far. It's a good way of doing it. But that doesn't, of course, account for any of the little trick bits that they had on the car that now have been taken away from them. That was the other big rumor, of course, wasn't it? Uh-huh. With oil burning.
Well, I was going to ask, because it's been one of the sort of... It always seems clandestine stories from the whole year. People whispering, oh, you know, there's oil. And then no one seems to be... Obviously, no one's going to admit to anything. But yeah, there was the speculation that actually this was all down to Ferrari. And lo and behold, Ferrari seemed on balance to be a little bit off the pace. Well, what can we make of this? Can we say anything for sure about this?
Well, I think what we can say for sure is that Mercedes started it all, mm-hmm. Because there is a paper trail of technical directives, and what people will admit to, like Red Bull team principal Christian Horner, is that when Mercedes started this, Red Bull initially and Renault, their engine department partner, requested clarifications, and those clarifications were forthcoming. They even made a rule, the FIA, towards next year, when everybody will have to account for every drop of oil that they have in their tanks. And so they'll be able to tell if people are using more oil than just takes to lubricate the engine. You know, you can tell if you start with, I don't know, whatever, 2 liters, and you end up with 1 liter, and that's because you've burnt the other liter. And so, what Christian Horner told us on the grid in Baku was he effectively identified James Allison as the originator of this latest technical directive. So, according to Horner, someone who now works for Mercedes. Mm-hmm. Who used to work for Ferrari, and we assume that's James Allison, although he might be talking about somebody from the engine department. We don't know, so maybe it's not James Allison, but anyway, that's what we assumed. Sought this technical directive. It was aimed towards Ferrari, and it's hurt Ferrari's competitiveness. And Johnny actually spoke to Kimi Raikkonen throughout the weekend, just as, you know, saying hello, and asking, you know, what is it about the championship fight at the moment. Kimi was saying, oh, you wouldn't believe it. It's like World War III going on. It's very intense. And I think this is important in terms of giving a context to Sebastian Vettel's mood mm-hmm. of the weekend when we go on to discuss the wheel banging.
Yeah.
There is this, you know, I did sense there was a bit of a persecution complex around Ferrari of the weekend. There were lots of questions about this oil burning. There were, we couldn't get a straight answer. So to answer your original question, short of just reporting what Christian Horner was saying, was that it seemed to be aimed towards Ferrari. You know, we don't have any more, anything more solid than that. But it might explain why Vettel was, had a, you know, we've got to make the most of this in a kind of putting up a good fight mindset, perhaps. If he felt that they'd been persecuted somewhat through technical directive, maybe he felt like, well, you know, we'll strike back type thing.
Mm-hmm. Well, we may as well go straight there as we'll get onto the race, and then we can go back and consider the drivers that actually won the Grand Prix, because that event really set up the entire result. The fact that Hamilton and Vettel, one through a fault of his own, the other through no fault of his own, took themselves out of contention for victory. That safety car period, the second of three, when Vettel nudged the back of Lewis Hamilton, and then, well, I mean, how can we describe this in a way that it you know, is straightforward and neutral? Really sideswiped Lewis Hamilton in a bit of a brain fade moment, and I don't know, in my opinion at least, was probably lucky not to be disqualified. I mean, what was your take on that event?
Okay, well, I think it all went back to the fact that the Baku circuit was has this very strange layout, or rather unique layout, it's not strange, in that the last corner is almost 2 kilometers away from where the pit lane starts. It's a long way, you know. I've been through that track both when it was under construction and for the last two races. And so when the safety car has the lights out and it goes around turn, I think it's 16, is it? Mm-hmm. What I know is the Four Seasons Hotel. The safety car then has to absolutely blat it down towards the pit lane. But I think the safety car's top speed is about 150, something like that. Mm-hmm. Maybe 160 tops. Anyway, it's got to absolutely blat it down there and has to make it into the pit lane. Now, of course, Lewis Hamilton, if he sees the lights off around the same corner or just before, then has to control the pack. He must hold the pack back to be sure that when he's going down there at 220 miles an hour, he's not going to catch and potentially pass the safety car. And on the first safety car restart, Hamilton was within 100 meters of getting close. It was that close. I've checked this with Mercedes today. Mm-hmm. He was 100 meters away from the safety car. And they saw this, and that prompted, do you remember there was a radio message?
Yes.
Where Hamilton's engineer said, "Careful, Lewis, you know, you were close to the safety car." Hamilton said, "I was nowhere near him." Mm-hmm. Well, he was 100 meters away. So, you know, in Hamilton's right in the sense that he was, you know, he was nowhere near him. I think it was a bit of a radio message saying, you know, yeah, all right, it was a bit close, but, you know, don't worry, FIA, I wasn't anywhere near him. The TV angle, I think, foreshortened the distance because it looked pretty close, didn't it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But when it was head on, that gives a sort of slightly untrue distance. So bearing in mind that Hamilton knew that when the lights went out, he had to just let the safety car get away so that by the time Hamilton was on full throttle, the safety car was already in the pit lane and Hamilton could resume racing. So that's number one reason why Hamilton would have been backing everybody up on the run down to the Four Seasons turn. The other reason, of course, is that he wanted to make Vettel maybe lose heat in his tyres and become vulnerable to Perez behind him. So he knew that Vettel was on what I call Old Faithful engine number one in a forced change after they had a problem in free practice three. He knew that engine was a little bit wheezy, you know, had already done four races, 300,500 kilometers, getting towards the end of its life. And he knew that what Perez would have in the back of his Mercedes, and if Perez could challenge Vettel and get ahead of him, perhaps on the restart, then all good for Hamilton. Mm-hmm. You know, there's the Force India taking more points off the Ferrari. So I think it was those two things that Hamilton was doing. I think it was probably primarily he didn't want to overtake the safety car because that's going to be, you know, big trouble. Mm-hmm. And I think, isn't that what Matsushita did in the GP2 race the previous year?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah,
exactly. So he kind of knew that, you know, there was precedent for that kind of thing. and that if he did have to back off so as not to overtake the safety car, you know, Vettel would certainly get him. Mm-hmm. And that would be obviously annoying. So that is the only reason why, the two reasons why Hamilton would be doing that. Mm-hmm. Obviously, when Vettel saw that he was backing off and interpreted that as a brake test, Vettel must have thought, oh, he's backing me up so that my tyres go off and so I'm vulnerable to Perez. But Vettel must have known as well the other more innocent reason, if you like, that Hamilton had to do it so he didn't overtake the safety car. But obviously he didn't, because he was furious and felt that it was a, it was a unfair move. Hence his, you know, bashing into the back of him and then bashing into the side of him. Although bashing into the back of him wasn't intentional, obviously, mm-hmm. but bashing into the side was. So, but as Hamilton said, I had zero motivation to brake test him.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's right, isn't it? Why would Hamilton, apart from having trying to break the Ferrari's front wing, what would have Hamilton's motivation be to brake test Vettel at that point?
Well, exactly right. And before we consider whether or not anything else will follow up from this, and then we can actually look at who won the Grand Prix. But you know, this is going to be one of those moments, isn't it? I mean, for Lewis Hamilton, as much as certainly I think this was largely an innocent situation, and there's always in the safety car situation that strategic element of backing up the pack, as you say, considering that Lewis, though, was complaining that his tyres were getting cold behind the safety car, at a minimum, do you think he should have expected there was a little bit of a risk that someone was going to nudge him from behind? Granted that, you know, it happened and he didn't follow up on that issue, but was that to a certain degree inevitable given all the considerations here regarding tyres and grip?
Yeah, maybe. And, you know, we've seen both him and Vettel do tricksy safety car restarts in the past, haven't we? Playing games and just trying to get the best safety car restart for themselves. You know, it's understandable why they do it. But, you know, then, of course, you've got the Vettel moving aside him and clonking into him. And I think there are two ways of looking at this. First of all, you know, you've got a lot of people now saying, oh, this is completely unacceptable, and you know, driving standards like this, you can't set a precedent, and these guys have got to be role models for young drivers. Mm-hmm. And I think Hamilton raised that point himself, didn't he?
Yeah,
about Vettel. But then you've got Vettel saying, well, hey, listen, you know, look, we're all men, and we drive with our elbows out, which was the only things that he would say about sideswiping him. He wouldn't really even address it particularly point by point. But when asked, he said, well, you know, we're all men out there. And I think it was almost like Vettel was sort of going back to the sort of 1970s and 1980s.
Yeah.
And this kind of thing happened quite a lot, didn't it? Mm-hmm. You know, you'd often see Senna or Piquet or Mansell or whoever, you know, give someone a little love tap, and everyone would kind of think afterwards, oh, well, you know, that was a bit naughty, but hey-ho, you know, it's all good racing. And actually, Vettel's got a point in that, if he does think that, hasn't he? Because, you know, there is this now, you know, ultra sensitive, hypersensitive way about Formula One, and you know, it's partly us, the media's fault. You know, we love a big story, and that you see something like that and it's got big story flashed all over it, you know, in purple lights, you think, oh, this is going to be a good story. and there's a bit of a health and safety culture, isn't there? It's like, oh, you can't do that, you know. Mm-hmm. It might be dangerous. Well, clearly it wasn't dangerous. There was a danger of breaking Vettel's car or Hamilton's car, you know, the suspension if you do that, but presumably Vettel knew what he was doing, even if it was a bit of a rush of blood to the head. So I can understand why Vettel was thinking, hey, look, you know, I just gave him a little bash to say, you know, you back me up into you and make me hit you, I'm going to hit you on the side just as a little warning. And he's thinking, what's all the fuss about? My issue isn't with that. My issue is with Vettel not then coming clean at the end of it.
Yeah.
And saying, and trying to sort of fluff around it, and I would have preferred it, and it would have been the Vettel that I know and love if he'd just come out and said, well, yeah, I thought he brake tested me, and so I gave him a little kiss to wake him up.
What,
you know,
of it? Yeah.
Cause what of it? Exactly. I'm a world champion, you know. This is battle out there. You know, I'm hard as nails street fighter. That's what I do. I would have respected him much more if he'd have said that, and I kind of wanted him to say that rather than not even half admit it and come out with what I call on TV alternative facts about about this stuff and trying to bluff it over. And I mean, he was talking to us and we were listening. Like, are we living in a parallel universe here? You know, he would try and divert the briefing back in the press briefing, the interview back into the brake test. And I was like, well, no, Seb, you know, we understand about that. And, you know, we've just discussed whether that was a brake test or not, or whether he was trying to back you up or back up because of the safety car. So the safety car get into the pits or make you vulnerable to Perez, whatever. Understand that. Mm-hmm. The sideswipe. And he was like, oh, well, you know, he wouldn't say, oh, yes, well, the sideswipe. You know, he refused to even acknowledge that it happened.
Mm. It was very awkward to watch the various interviews. It was just sort of a bit, I don't know, cringy just to see. Yeah, so actively avoid.
Is that what you meant? I mean, what did you make of it from a distance?
Everyone obviously saw the replay and saw what happened and saw the deliberate nature of it. And just, as you sort of say, the lack of acknowledgement in a way that he almost pretended as if he didn't know what anybody was talking about. You know, I think in the various interviews that are up online on the F1 website, I think there was one single moment in all of those minutes where he got close to saying that something happened. But the rest of the time is like, oh, what about the crash? Oh, you mean the brake test? No, the crash. Yeah. Well, obviously we know what Hamilton did. And it's like, well, come on.
Come on. And that's what I mean, you know. And people are pointing the finger at Hamilton. It was a brake test, and we're talking about that and spoken about that. And I don't know. I mean, clearly Hamilton's probably not completely blameless, and a lot of other people have pointed to the to Hamilton's games with trying to get the team to back Valtteri Bottas into Sebastian Vettel later in the race, because Hamilton was so furious with the whole situation that Vettel ended up ahead of him post headrest and desperately wants to get by him. And clearly that was a misstep by Hamilton. That wasn't a particularly fair call, wasn't it? You know, he wouldn't have known, or obviously didn't know, that Bottas was driving his own race trying to hunt down Stroll for second. He was told very quickly on the radio that was the case, so Bottas wouldn't start being, you know, servant to Lewis Hamilton. But that was that didn't particularly ring, you know, fair and sportsmanlike, did it? Asking the team to use Bottas in a kind of team order situation to compromise his own race. But he was told that, listen, Bottas is in his own race, and then he sort of, you know, must have thought, oh, well, you know, I better go on with it myself. But so many different angles to this.
Well, one thing's for certain, and the backslapping nature of this championship is probably over, you'd think.
Yeah.
No more of this sort of, oh, good race, guys. We did well. We'll look forward to seeing how that unfolds in 2 weeks. But let's, talking of Bottas, segue over to the men who finished on the podium, because Bottas and Ricciardo. Now, Ricciardo obviously won this race with an enormous recovery drive. Bottas finished second in what I think was, just because of the fact that we had so many events in this race and because Daniel Ricciardo won in a similar way, but Bottas arguably had the bigger recovery here, considering a lap down, obviously could unlap himself behind the safety car, but, you know, recovered from some damage from last place to finish second and only, what was it, 3.94 seconds behind Daniel Ricciardo.
Yep.
I mean, these were big, even if they weren't strategic, but enormous drives here for the victory in second place.
Yeah, and I was actually following his lap times, Bottas's lap times in pursuit of Stroll. And they were brilliant. It was 44s and 43s all over the place, whereas Stroll was sort of 45s and 46s. And it was inevitable, from what I was watching, that he was going to get him, actually. He got him much later than I thought he was going to get him. But so that, to me, demonstrated, you know, the turnaround that Mercedes have made, and that they could easily, if the situations had been different, had at least you know, a 1-2 or even a 1-3 had Bottas not got together with Kimi, you know, on the opening lap. And it's such a long race. You just thought, you know, in retrospect, all those people who did tangle at those first sort of 90 degree lefts and rights, well, they're all left-handers, actually. Turn 1's a left-hander, turn 2's a left-hander, turn 3's a left-hander. Yeah. That, you know, had they been a bit more circumspect, they would have all been in better shape come the end of the race. But Bottas showed what the pace of that Mercedes really was, and it was a great drive. You know, absolutely stunning. Never give up, as he says, and he proved that.
It is interesting in that context. Now, obviously, great drives from these two guys. But it does put into, I suppose, a little bit of a perspective. I mean, it all finished very closely. Yes, we had three safety cars to bunch them up. But the idea that these two guys could come from pretty much last in the field to win the race, I think does underline the fact that we do have front runners that are just that much faster than most of the midfield. I mean, they didn't have too much trouble passing most of these cars. Daniel Ricciardo passed three at once, just for good measure at one point. It delivered a good race this time round, but I suppose that really just go to show how big the gap is now.
Yeah, but it was red flag as well. Let's not forget that, because Ricciardo would have had to... Ricciardo got a fresh set of tyres for nothing under the red flag, and he would have been... He was already on old, much older super soft tyres going to the end, having done his mandatory switch to the softs after the early lap shenanigans and getting the brakes overheating and all of that. So he got the change out of the way and was going to go long to the end on one set of super softs. But then he got a fresh set of super softs with everybody else, and he already had improved track position under red flag. That's how he got that. So, yeah, the red flag helped, as you say, Bottas and Ricciardo, and the likes of Kimi Raikkonen and, you know, Sergio Perez. Ocon as well. Ocon with his bent front suspension. Well, it was both. Yeah, both Perez and Ocon rejoined, didn't they? So, the red flag really, really helped everybody.
We talk about Perez and Ocon. In some respects, the forgotten drivers of this race, because, as you say, some of the drivers that could have afforded to be a little bit more circumspect early on, they had a coming together after the second safety car, I think it was, when, unbeknownst to them at the time, obviously, were accidentally in a race-winning position, really. After Vettel and Hamilton had taken themselves out of this race, this could really have been a Force India 1-2.
Yes, it could. And that wasn't lost on everyone at Force India, who were extremely irritated about it afterwards. And you know, that's a mark of how successful I think Esteban Ocon has been coming into this team, and how they've really chosen. You know, the upside of that, it's a nice problem to have, is that they are getting very, very close in competitiveness, Perez and Ocon. And if you look at Ocon's graph, I can see him, he's kind of at Perez's level, having not been at Perez's level for the first four or five races of the year, arguably five or six races of the year. Ocon seems to be now, towards mid-season, getting to be at Perez's level. And it's interesting to see where that graph's going to be, whether Ocon towards the end of the season will be faster than Perez. And then, you know, Sergio better sign that new Ferrari deal now, because he might start to be shown up by this, you know, lanky, gangly, slightly hunched forward Esteban Ocon. I've started worrying about his posture.
Oh,
by the way, Esteban Ocon. I was studying it in quite some detail. He needs to stand up. I think he spent too long, because he's a good 6'2".
Mm-hmm.
I think he spent too long in racing cars, being strapped in with two tight seat belts, and he's starting to get curved shoulders. And I want him to put his shoulders in to back, and, you know, put his head up. I think he needs some lessons in Alexander technique.
You know, I've seen an ad for it. This is completely off the topic, but an ad for a device that you stick onto your neck, and it buzzes when you have poor posture. So maybe maybe that could be a Christmas gift from you to him. Who's to say?
But I can understand. You know, it's being bolted into these cars, and having to sort of hunch forward to get his head low and get the low center of gravity is giving him rounded shoulders and a, you know, not great posture. Anyway, how do we get onto this?
That relationship at Force India, though, I do want to pursue that further, because we saw this in Canada, that there was a little bit of niggle there regarding their pursuit of Daniel Ricciardo at the end of the Grand Prix. Now we have this collision racing incident, but nonetheless, and as you say, we have these two drivers now on more or less the same racing level, and the idea of a Ferrari contract in the mix next year for at least one of them. Considering this team is, well, they want to consolidate fourth, and if Red Bull were to trip up, they would love to have a go at third. How much is that going to potentially undermine what has up to this point been a pretty well-functioning, very slick team?
I don't know, because I think fourth is pretty safe for them, actually, don't you? I mean, okay, you could argue that, you know, Williams has started to get their act together, but really it seems to be only one car is scoring big points at a time. And while Felipe Massa kind of, you know, knocks in pretty consistent points when he's having a good weekend, you get Stroll with a massive points haul for third place in a crazy race. But you've got to think that when it comes to a lot of other people finishing, he's mm-hmm. probably just going to be at best finishing in those, you know, 6th, 7th, 8th, 9th places with Massa. And Force India have already got a bit of a cushion there. So I think they'll view it as a nice problem to have. They need somebody to take a bit of a leading role and crack down on the two. No more nonsense. Whether that's Vijay, you know, in mm-hmm. absentia doing that, or Otmar Szafnauer, or Tom McCulloch, who seems to be in charge, the chief race engineer. From what Bob Fernley was telling me on Friday, it's Tom McCulloch who's kind of in charge of the way they go racing at the circuit, backed up by Otmar Szafnauer. So one of them's got to, you know, bang their fists on the table and says, that's it, that's the lot, no more for the rest of the season, lads.
Well, we'll see how that one unfolds. You mentioned there Lance Stroll. We've got to mention Williams here, because obviously Stroll, his first podium. He's not the youngest podium getter, though, is he? I think there's like an asterisk, youngest debutante podium getter or something to that effect. He's nonetheless very young.
It was 12 days, wasn't it?
Something like that. Yeah, very close.
I think he's 12 days older than Verstappen when Verstappen got his first podium.
Well, 12 days is an age in Formula One in terms of age, racing ages, isn't it? So, you know, it doesn't count.
It's something like that.
Yeah, but Williams was in a good position. As you say, a lot of cars, after they dropped out, suddenly found themselves in this podium contention. Felipe Massa felt he could have won this race had he not had a suspension problem. But this could potentially be the moment that, I mean, as you say, up to this point, Williams has been scoring largely with one car, that they do start to get a little bit more onto even footing. I mean, he looked very comfortable in Azerbaijan, did Lance Stroll?
Well, he did, and that's the strange thing. So what was it about Azerbaijan, which is a hard track?
I've played it in F1 2016.
Yeah, that put Lance Stroll in his comfort zone, as opposed to some other tracks where it hasn't worked for him and he's ended up, you know, in trouble. I mean, I thought that was weird. I thought, wow, if he can be really comfortable around the streets where there's not really any room for error, and there are some very, very fast parts of that track, as well as some technical parts, then you've got to say that bodes pretty well for Lance Stroll for the rest of the season. And, you know, as his dad is quick to remind everybody, this is only week 8 of his Formula One career. I mean, we think, you know, because he's done a fair bit of testing and he's been kind of at it for a long time, you know, he should be delivering almost after the first couple of races. You know, I will give him a couple of races settle in, but you know, right now you've got to deliver. It's only week 8 really, isn't it? So let's wait and see what he can do, because you know, he's dominated and won Euro F3, the last championship he's done. Yeah, I'm really interested to see how that goes.
Well, everyone just compares rookies now to Max Verstappen, don't they? Considering he was so young and was so impressive when he came in, everyone's just sort of expected to be child prodigy Max Verstappen. It kind of hurts situations like this, doesn't it? There's no opportunity for a driver to still be a rookie almost.
Yeah, that's true. And there's no testing like there was, say, when Hamilton came in, having won the GP2 championship and did a whole winter's full of testing at McLaren before he came in 2007. So that's true. Yeah. And you have to be, of course, Verstappen's raised the bar for rookies coming in. He's clearly exceptional. That's why maybe we're not seeing quite the bankable youths coming in, if you like, you know, if there are any. Red Bull farming Pierre Gasly out to race in Japan, you know, Ferrari looking at Charles Leclerc and wanting him to do, you know, win at least this year's F2, and then you'd think they'll look to place him somewhere similar for next year before getting into Formula One, if there is a place or wherever, you know. And even someone as experienced as Pascal Wehrlein as a Mercedes junior, only now starting to deliver and look, you know, pretty special you know, his second year already of F1. Mm-hmm.
Now, before we end with McLaren, because that is traditionally where we seem to end with on this program for one reason or another, you obviously have a relatively unique vantage, I suppose, in the pit lane. This wasn't a particularly strategic race, but in that were nonetheless some calls that needed to be made quite quickly. Talk specifically about the likes of Ricciardo and Bottas and some other drivers caught up in some of those early lap tangles. And we know that Red Bull and Ricciardo have both said, well, we had no expectation to win this race almost at any point until we got more or less to that red flag period. Mm. How much of races like this, and races more generally where there are these quick calls, is this all really like slick strategy that is very pre-thought out? Or is there a degree of, well, we'll give it a go and we'll see what happens, given that one answer could potentially undermine the entire purpose of this program?
Well, they've all got computer programs, which if they... It comes up and says, if pit now, position will be, mm-hmm. and then it says, and if you don't pit now, position will be, and then it says, you know, P6, or if you pit now, position will be P3. And so then it's quite an easy decision to make. And so really the trick to it is whether you believe the computer or whether you go out on a limb. And that's where you find some of the more inspired strategic calls. Mm-hmm. And a lot of teams, you know, trust the computers. And Mercedes, for example, they've got a very good system developed by James Vowles himself and his teammates. But then sometimes they get caught out by, when was it when they pitted, I think it was in Canada, when they pitted Bottas, mm-hmm. and he came out and got stuck behind Ocon, wasn't it?
Yeah.
And they thought that they were going to pit, and then they didn't, mm-hmm. and that kind of threw the computer model, you know, off a bit. So it's an interesting one, isn't it? And then you've got these deals being done, like the one that we saw at Sauber this race, mm-hmm. as well, where they made Marcus Ericsson let Pascal Wehrlein through, so that who was quicker, so he could try and have a go at Alonso, and Ericsson could try and stave off the approach from Stoffel van Dorn behind, mm-hmm. him and guarantee the points. And they said, okay, if Pascal Wehrlein can't get Alonso, we'll let you, Ericsson, back through. Because van Dorn was so close behind Ericsson, they couldn't actually do that, because van Dorn would have nicked the point and would have mm-hmm. you know, got both of them. And Ericsson, yeah, that didn't work for him. So when you see these strategic games being played and drivers being asked to swap positions and then refusing, you can understand increasingly why they do refuse, mm-hmm. Because history does suggest that you know, you won't get rewarded for being a gentleman in these situations. Toro Rosso's shown that in the past, hasn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, well, exactly right.
When they've refused to do stuff like that. But yeah, it's with Red Bull, I mean, and with all the teams, actually, the first safety car coming as it did, I think, on lap 12 was absolutely heaven sent, mm-hmm. because that was plum first stop territory anyway. So that was a very easy call for everyone to come and do a pit stop and go onto the soft tyre, as they thought if it had been a dull race from then on, everyone would just go to the end on the soft tyre. But of course that wasn't what it turned out to be.
Exactly. Now, if we do look to Alonso, who, as you mentioned there, was finishing ahead of Pascal Wehrlein. First points for McLaren. The unhappiest first points of a season I think I've ever seen. They should have won this race, they say, had they been with any other engine other than Honda. I guess first question is, I mean, this should have been at least some glimmer of hope for McLaren, I suppose. Do you think they were amping this up a little bit, given the very obvious political situation that is engulfing this team?
Yes, I think that's actually a very accurate and wise interpretation of why they were so glum. You're right. I mean, I expected, I went and got Eric Boulier straight off the pit wall, and I expected him to at least crack a smile. And it was almost theatrical, his mm-hmm. kind of scowl about the whole thing. And I was almost like, oh, cheer up, Eric, you know, come on, give us a smile. And that's the way I read that as well, mm-hmm. That it was almost like, you know, look how bad they are. We could have won this race. And, I mean, they could have won the race had they had a better engine, because of course this is the kind of the race that Fernando Alonso is completely on top of.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he knew exactly what was going down in a crazy race like this. He's a master of crazy races like this, and they only made the one stop. It was under the safety car.
Mm-hmm.
They would have only made their second stop to the fresher tyres under the red flag. You know, they would never have spent more. Alonso wouldn't have spent more time in the pits than he absolutely had to. You know, he knew what to do and when, and who to pick off and what to watch for. And yes, had he not been passed by pretty much everybody on the straights and had his own harvesting and battery problems. And I don't think they were fuel constrained in the end because of the red flag. So I don't think that would have been an issue for them. Then it's a race that he could have won. But hey, you know, Sebastian Vettel and Lewis Hamilton could have won it, but for the famous headrest, which we haven't spoken about yet.
No, well, it's interesting, isn't it? Because what an unusual problem. Every season we get one of these weird problems that afflict a car, but they're not really willing to say exactly how this happens, is it?
No.
I know Toto Wolff was very defensive after the race as well.
Well, yeah, he kind of had a sort of mini go at me. I tell you what the background to that is, that before I did that interview, he was talking to Niki Lauda, and then I seem to remember that Helmut Marko came up, and I think Helmut Marko, fellow Austrian to Lauda and Wolff, made some kind of comment about the headrest that wound. Because when I started the interview, Toto was all, you know, he was like smiles, you know, we just finished watching the podium. Mm. Bottas had come off the podium and he was like, okay, well, you know, at least I've got a podium. And there were smiles, and Toto had just finished a conversation. I couldn't hear because I don't tend to take my headphones and eavesdrop in conversations, but I wonder whether Helmut Marko had wound him up about the headrests. It's like, you know, we only won because you can't put a headrest, keep a headrest in. And suddenly Toto was, you know, he was steaming. And so I asked one question about, you know, okay, where do we start? Let's start with the headrest. And he said, I don't know what it was. And I asked another question with the intention of saying, well, thinking, well, maybe, you know, when they took it off, they found that some of the locating plugs or pins or, you know, slider had broken off, or because they must have seen, you know, or if there had been a problem or one of the pins was broken. I don't know. I thought there must be more to it. And he kind of jumped down my throat slightly with a kind of, I don't like the implication of your question is that, you know, there's one mechanic whose fault it is, who's made a problem, and we don't look for scapegoats in the company. I was like, well, hang on, all right, I only asked a question. I didn't suggest that it was he obviously thought that I was suggesting that it was one mechanic's fault, you know, some finger trouble. So maybe, I don't know, maybe it will come out that it was one mechanic's fault and that it was some finger trouble and they hadn't secured it properly. Certainly when they put the replacement in at the pit stop, that was quite quickly put in and then just secured, and then he went off and it was fine after that, wasn't it? So that would suggest that it wasn't a problem with the mounting points on the car. Otherwise that one would have probably come loose as well. So, you know, I don't know. I mean, I've spoken to Mercedes since then and they've said that, you know, I think Toto was just angry and disappointed and wasn't feeling that I was fishing for, you know, him to name names at what mechanic had done, and that certainly wasn't my intention. Oh, you know, I wasn't looking for name names. I don't want to, that's not the way I do interviews. I was just thinking, you know, as a person watching it, I wanted to better understand how that kind of thing could happen. But Toto was and they've since released a story on their website, haven't they?
It's a blog post about teamwork and
a blog post about teamwork and pointing towards my question that seems to have been so inflammatory. It's like, all right, I was only asking a question.
I suppose they've taken it to heart for one reason or another. Well, anyway, it gave us something to talk about, so that's always that's always something to go on from there. It was an interesting race. It was an action-y race, at very least, even if there wasn't a whole heap of strategy. And certainly it gave us something to talk about in terms of the championship. The gloves are properly off now when we head over to Austria for the next round of the season. Do you think there's going to be a lot more in this, or are we going to go back to racing as usual?
I think we'll probably go around back to racing as usual until we get to somewhere like Monza. something always happens at Monza, doesn't it? And then Singapore, that's a high pressure race. Something will happen at Singapore. Silverstone, with the partisan Hamilton crowd. Vettel is in for an absolute roasting from the crowd. You know, there'll be lots of road rage banners, and there'll be all sorts of ribbing, good natured and otherwise, from the British crowd at Silverstone when Vettel comes here. I think they'll probably want to cool it a bit. I wonder whether Hamilton went slightly over the top with his. I was disgusted with with Vettel's behaviour, and he was certainly not wasting an opportunity to put the boot in, wasn't he? in his post race quotes, knowing that they would be eagerly lapped up by the waiting journos, which they were. And hey, listen, you know, I'm sure he feels that way, but it's certainly been manna from heaven, hasn't it, for the press and for the media like us to actually, you know, further the story, to take the story on then, you know, when Hamilton comes out and just underlines that he thought it was a very unsportsmanlike move and he was very cross with Vettel. But hey ho, you know. It's all a bit of handbags, as we say around here.
Oh, in the end, yeah. It's all just sport, isn't it? This Formula One game. It's nothing much to it at the end. It's just faster than some other sports. Yeah. Ted, it's been a pleasure to have you on to look back at the Azerbaijan Grand Prix. Speak to you next time.
Yeah, good stuff. Thank you.
That was the strategy report for the 2017 Azerbaijan Grand Prix. But if you want to read more about the strategy from this week's race, go to f1strategyreport.com for all the pit stop stats, tyre data, and Jack Leslie's write-up of all the action from Baku. The strategy report is powered by the 2017 edition of Apex Race Manager, the number one new racing game in Germany, Italy, and Australia. You can download Apex Race Manager for free for iOS and Android devices. My name's Michael Laminato. You can find me at Michael Laminato on Twitter, and I'll catch you in 2 weeks' time from the Red Bull Ring for the Austrian Grand Prix.